To figure things out. Hey, now we're live. Hey, folks, thanks for tuning into the Banff Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty. And with us today, legendary comic book writer Ron Mars has decided to grace us with his presence and give us a modicum of respectability. Mr. Mars, thank you very much for coming by.
When you say Mr. Mars, I look around for my dad.
All right, I'll just call you Ron then.
who's passed away these many years, so I've actually find him. We do have a podcast.
Yeah.
And with us today are two frequent co-hosts, Christopher McLaughlin. Hey, Chris.
Hey.
And Walt Rebilliard. Hey, Walt.
I'm feeling man cave shame.
Ron does have a nice man cave. You got a lot of cool figurines back there, Ron.
Yeah, there's actually a bunch more in the basement that I need to find some shelf space, but I haven't been able to get out to IKEA and buy more display shelves. So my buddy Paul Harding, who has generously graced me with a lot of the stuff that he sculpts, gives me grief every time he comes over because most of that stuff is still in a box on a shelf downstairs.
Well, it's hard to find room, right?
Yeah. At a certain point, you kind of reach critical mass, and there's no more space. So that's kind of what's been sitting around up there for years. Most of the stuff on the top is actually sculpted by my buddy Ruben Procopio, who sculpted for Disney and now does storyboards. So one day a huge box of boxes showed up at the house, and Ruben had sent me, like 8 or 10 statues. So so if you're jealous of my man cave, know that I didn't pay for most of it either. So more jealous.
You know, if you need room, I'm sure some of us would pay you for the shipping.
Well, Ron, let's just do a quick introduction in case we have a totally miseducated viewer who doesn't know who you are. You're probably best well known for writing Green Lantern for a very long time during the Kyle Rayner period. And let's see, last time you were on, you had a cool vampire comic you were promoting. And let's see, prior to that, I know you got into the business working with Mr. Starlin. Am I missing any highlights from your resume?
I've gotten to play with most of the toys in most of the places. So Silver Surfer, Thor, Green Lantern, Marvel versus DC, Star Wars, Batman Aliens, Batman Tarzan. So I'm very fortunate in that I've been able to get my hands on a lot of different projects. And I tell people it's better. What I do is a lot better than working for a living because I just get to make stuff up and they pay me.
And not to bury the lead too much, but you're here today to talk about what you're doing right now, which is you are the editor on the Stretch Star Omnibus. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I'm the editor in chief and part owner at Ominous Press, which is part of a larger parent company we're putting together called Creation Inc. And we've done a number of projects. We're doing stuff through IDW. The current thing that's on Kickstarter right now is a 3-volume omnibus of Jim Starlin's Dreadstar. And this is, obviously I got into the business thanks to Jim, took me by the hand and led me into Marvel and showed me the ropes. I've been doing it ever since. So in some ways, this is kind of coming full circle for me, getting together with Jim and putting together these three books. Like you said, it's on Kickstarter right now, and it's going to be 3 volumes of about 1,500 pages, 1,500 pages total, not 1,500 pages each. And it's all of Jim's Dreadstar stuff, from the painted Metamorphosis Odyssey stuff to the graphic novels to the monthly series that he wrote and drew for quite a while and then eventually just wrote and other artists came in and drew. So it'll run up through issue 40 of the regular series, which is when Jim stepped aside and other people came in and took it over. So okay. it is the cosmic odyssey that Jim Starlin put together that doesn't have Thanos in it.
Yeah. So this is really the first time all this material has been available in one place, right? Because it's kind of been scattered across various publishers.
Yeah, it's been scattered across various publishers, but there have been a few collections, but it's never been, we've never gotten the full Starlin Dreadstar in one place before. And the cool thing about it is Jim has actually gone through every one of the 1500 pages and remastered the color, made tweaks to the art.
Took out the coffee cup.
There's a few things that were tweaked. There's actually a few pages that were sort of recap pages that he took out so that it doesn't, you know, that doesn't sort of stop you in your tracks when you're reading it. So this is Dreadstar as Jim intended. And the printing technology at the time wouldn't really allow. So we were able to go through, and we even went back into the original lettering and fixed a few typos. And this is, God willing, if the editor did his job, this is exactly what Dreadstar was intended to be all along. Wow. And we actually have our first, we have the first copies off the press. So it is, and I got to say, it's pretty lovely and has that awesome new book smell that everybody loves.
And that looks so beefy. You could bludgeon a dude with that.
Oh yeah. So these literally came off the press last week, dried, and then were shipped out. So we have the first batch of hardcovers in, and, you know, there are more copies of volume one on the way, and then volume two and volume three are going to press later this month. And then, then it's the slow process of approving it all and getting it shipped and getting it fulfilled. But so far we're thrilled. I just did Free Comic Book Day in Buffalo with Jim, which is where the Ominous offices are located. So this was our first chance to actually see the finished book. And, he's real happy. If he's real happy, I'm real happy. And this is also, that's new Jim Starlin artwork, which we didn't think there would be any more of, because he blew a hole in his hand in an accident a couple of years ago. Ooh. And just kind of, got to the point where he thought, well, I'm not gonna be able to draw anymore. The muscles had been, torn up enough that the fine motor skills to actually pencil and ink were not there. But through, really nothing more than sheer will and determination, Jim's back to drawing a little bit. So each cover of the Omnibus volumes has a new Jim Starlin cover on it, and the slip case that will contain all three volumes, if you should so desire, has brand new Starlin artwork as well.
How has the reception been from some of the fans on the Kickstarter, and what kind of interaction have you guys had with them?
You know, we thought it would do well because it's Starlin, it's Dreadstar. A few people here and there have heard about this Avengers movie coming out.
Is there an Avengers movie?
It's not an accident that we timed the Kickstarter to be sort of in the middle of all that, because we're not stupid. But the initial Kickstarter funded in 12 hours. So,
you're about 400% now, right?
We've got 6 days left and we're just shy of 90,000, I think. And we would love to push it over 100,000 just because six figures would be kind of cool. Well, and that also allows us to have some, to have a bit of a slush fund for any other projects that might come down the road with Ominous and Jim and Dreadstar, he said, planting a seed that everybody should talk about and speculate on.
Hey, Ryan, tell us more about that.
So we would actually love to get it over, get it over 100,000 just because it'd be cool. But the response has been tremendous. I think, obviously, there's a core of Dreadstar fans out there, but I think we're also getting people who are checking it out for the first time and looking to introduce themselves to Dreadstar, because, if the only other way to do that really was to, kind of pick through back issue bins, and the publication history spanned enough different publishers and enough different formats so that it'd be kind of tough to actually put together the whole run.
And when this all came about, how tough was it for you guys to get all of that original stuff and access to that original stuff?
Well, Jim had a chunk of it. And he, you know, he took on the responsibility of, okay, I'll get it all scanned and I'll fix all the color and take out any, you know, Benday dots that might be in the artwork and fit, you know, so that was all Jim's responsibility, and it took months. And he actually had found that he didn't have some issues. So he actually had to go on eBay and buy some of his own Dreadstar comics so that he could scan them and then fix all the color. I was actually at Jim's house not that long ago when he told me that story, and I was like, don't you think you just could have put the word out on Facebook and somebody would have sent you those books? He's like, it was easy. it was easier to just go on eBay. But the reproduction has been pretty great. And you know, it's the original, you know, it's the original color palette. It's what came out initially, but it's better. And there are any mistakes in the color, any mistakes in the lettering have all been fixed now.
So it didn't take an entire team of the Sopranos to make this happen.
No, it did not. It took one team of Jim Starlin.
So is it too early to ask you about this mysterious project you mentioned, or was that you just planting the seed and we'll hear more about that about that later?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
All right. Spreading rumor and uncertainty. Well, okay. So Kickstarter's going great. You guys, like I said, you're about 400%. And you're shipping to anywhere in the world, which is not something you always see in Kickstarters these days. So that's pretty cool.
Well, you have to, you know, obviously we've done a few Kickstarters with Ominous now, and it's a great platform. It's a great tool to be able to do that, to reach the audience, to connect directly with the fans. But it, you know, there's a huge learning curve to it. And you have to understand what you're getting into. I know there are always tales of Kickstarters that have funded, seemingly been hugely successful. And then, you know, the people figure out, oh, we didn't charge enough for shipping. And you know, any profit they made just gets eaten up in actually fulfilling the thing. So thankfully we haven't been down that road, and we've learned enough in the process that you charge your shipping afterwards, and different shipping zones have different costs, and it's there are a lot of tools out there when you do a Kickstarter that help you. That help you get to it. You just have to know where those tools are and utilize them. But you know, we're happy to ship anywhere in the world. It just takes a bit longer if you're in New Zealand and you want one of these. It's going to take a little while to get to you, but you're going to get it.
Cool. We run some small podcasts ourselves, and yeah, shipping will kill you, especially international shipping. It can be crazy.
It's a learning curve, and thankfully we were able to talk to a lot of different people that did a number of Kickstarters before we ever even jumped into the first one. And, you know, like I said, it's a great platform, but you certainly earn that money. It's not like, you know, it's not like $90,000 just drops out of the sky and, you know, they reward you for putting up a, you know, Dreadstar omnibus. You work for that money, pretty much on a daily basis. And thankfully we have a team in place that does a lot of this stuff. We have people that put the pages together and handle the updates, and I guess maybe most importantly, we have people in the office that deal with the shipping, because that's a huge burden. When we fulfill a project, there are 200 or 300 packages a day that are going out of the office, and they all have to be checked to make sure that everybody's got the right rewards. It's got to be packed carefully so that nothing's damaged or bent, thrown into the box, wrapped up. It's a time-consuming process, and then inevitably something gets damaged in shipping and you got to replace it. It's not like you do it once and then you walk away. It's an ongoing process because stuff gets lost, stuff gets damaged, and you really have to make sure that everybody gets, you know, everybody gets satisfaction, because you want them to trust you whenever you put up a Kickstarter, that they're going to get, you know, a quality product, and it's going to reach them in perfect shape.
Yeah, no, I understand completely. I once had to send a book 4 times to a guy in Brazil, just because his local post service wasn't up to snuff. So,
well, or there was a fan in the post office that was just late finger and stuff.
Yeah, they got 3 copies of it now. So.
Can you talk a little bit about the because anybody looking at the video can obviously see that you really don't know anything about statues or to scale figures, but can you talk a little bit about the reward tier that includes the Vanth? Did I pronounce that correctly? Figure
Red Star statue. Yeah. So the aforementioned Paul Harding, who's one of my best buddies and lives half hour away. Paul's also a big fan of Jim's stuff and now friends with Jim. And when we started talking about this, Paul and Jim started talking about doing a Dread Star statue because one has not existed yet. There's no real, Dread Star came out and was a big deal before the marketing boom and the product boom that now you can get a green Thanos Funko Pop on every corner. So Paul came up with the sculpt, and Jim approved it, and they tweaked stuff here and there. So obviously it takes a while to generate a statue. So the statue part of the Kickstarter will fulfill probably after Volume 3 is actually done and printed. But we're definitely doing it, and thankfully Paul knows all the right strings to pull to get something like that up and running and working and manufactured and painted and all that. So it's that's a much longer process, but we're kind of dipping our foot into that pool, and probably not the last statue that we'll do.
Nice.
I've been kind of struck by the ubiquity of Funko Pop in the last couple of years. The 7-Eleven on my corner literally sells Funko Pops at the counter.
Yeah, well, it's, you go to any convention anywhere, and there's a fair chance you're going to find more booths selling Funko Pops than you're going to find booths selling actual comics. That's the world in which we live now. I'm not judging, but it's pretty incredible that all of this stuff has somehow filtered its way into the mainstream. 10 years ago, before Iron Man, really, before there was a huge presence of this stuff in the mainstream, I don't think we could have imagined that you'd walk into a Barnes & Noble and there would be not only a huge rack of graphic novels, but like a mountain of Funko Pops just waiting for grandma and grandpa to come along and buy him the stocking stuffers.
Yeah, my Barnes & Noble has a whole shelf just for Rick and Morty games.
The revolution has occurred and we won, apparently.
Uphill battle.
So can you give us any hints about what's coming from Ominous Press in the future?
We've got a few different projects that are going to be in Kickstarters in the next few months. We'll finish. Obviously we'll do Kickstarters for Volumes 2 and 3 of Dreadstar as well, for people that weren't able or didn't want to pick up all three at once. So we'll sell them individually as well as in a box set. I'm working on a graphic novel with Rick Leonardi that'll come out through Ominous. I'm working on a graphic novel with Peter Krause that will come out through Ominous. We have different hardcover packages of some of the previous material that we've done with IDW, Dread Gods and Demigod. And my World War II graphic novel with Darryl Banks that I worked with on Green Lantern is about a half dozen pages from completion right now. And so we're doing that. It's called Harkins Raiders. We did a Kickstarter for that late last year, right around Christmas. and Daryl is finishing up the last batch of pages after being in the hospital with the flu and, you know, a few other setbacks that, you know, real life happens. So we're doing that, probably sending it off to press this month. And that will go along with an art book of Daryl Banks' stuff called The Black Book. And that's a series of art books that we've done with Jim Starlin, Bart Sears, Andy Smith, Graham Nolan. We'll do one with Rick Leonardi in the near future. So, you know, lots of different odds and ends. And most of that stuff is available for purchase just from Ominous Press. You can just go to the website, ominouspress.com, and there's a Shopify page. And like I said, we have very helpful shipping elves who grab stuff out of the stock room and put them in a box and send them to your house.
I'll have to check out Harkins Raiders because I love a good World War II comic, and this was under my radar completely somehow last November.
We knew that it was a little bit of an uphill battle because we were doing the Kickstarter in December, and you know, obviously people have other things on their minds in December. They have other things to draw their attention. But we decided, well, let's go ahead and get it live, get it funded, and we can be working on it. So rather than wait until the new year, we got that done. Right at the end of last year, I think we closed up a few days before Christmas, and it's a, you know, it's kind of a throwback story to the sort of movies of World War II that you would get in the '70s, you know, '60s and '70s, Dirty Dozen, that kind of stuff. Not quite so grim and gritty as Saving Private Ryan, more like the Dirty Dozen, like Kelly's Heroes, that kind of stuff.
So, you have a backup story with you and Sean Isaacs. We had Sean on a couple months ago to talk about his work at Marvel right now.
That's Sean Isaacs is a scamp. I just saw him. I just saw him about 2 weeks ago in his homeland of South Africa. I was fortunate enough to go over and do a convention appearance over there. So unfortunately, Sean and I ate a lot of meals together.
Why is that unfortunate?
Well, he's just a savage. You can't take him anywhere.
Yeah, we had him on to talk about that last big Avengers event. I forget which one. No Road Home, maybe?
No Road Home.
Yeah, he was working overnight. I could talk to us in the daytime because he was up late, you know, drawing all the Avengers. And
Sean is, all sort of bullshit aside, he's just a terrific artist. He was... We got to be friends a number of years ago where I just happened to see his stuff, I think, on Twitter, and we just got to connect and have sort of been looking to work on something together for a while. And he just keeps getting better and better. The backup story that he's doing for Harkins is tremendous. It stars the dog from Harkins Raiders.
Alfie.
There's a bulldog. So
hello.
So, you know, there's obviously no one better to be drawing a story about a bulldog than Sean. So he's almost done with that as well. So it's kind of a race to the finish line for both him and Daryl, who gets done first. And then we'll put the whole thing together. But Sean's tremendous. I'm so pleased with his success and his notoriety because he, you know, his stuff is great. He works really hard and you know, honestly, I was really glad that we got to hang out in South Africa as much as we did because obviously he had deadlines hanging over his head. But on the other hand, I flew for 15 hours to get there. So he kind of owed me.
it's a long way, that's for sure. Yeah, we know him from role-playing games. That's kind of where he got started before he broke into the big time.
Yeah, well, he was at the convention that, you know, that I was a guest at. He was there and we did a panel together along with Jason Masters. And then later in the day, he said, well, I'm going to go play D&D for a while, so I'll see you guys later. So so he disappeared and actually did a D&D session with some of the other guests at the con or some of the other attendees at the con. And then, you know, we met up again for dinner. And oddly, he wanted to go to Hooters for dinner because he likes chicken wings. So like, dude, I didn't come to South Africa to go to Hooters.
Not what you call local cuisine.
So we had dinner, and then he went to Hooters to get
Is that the savage part you were talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God, he's hysterical. Did he have his dog with him the whole time?
No, the convention itself and where they put us up and everything was in a big casino complex. So I don't know. I don't think I saw any dogs in the casino. So maybe they frown on that there. I don't know.
Oh my God. That's fantastic. I can't wait to hit him with this on Twitter.
Yeah, just ask him about his wings.
Oh, it's going there.
I had no idea they even had a Hooters in South Africa. That's quirky. I wouldn't have thought it'd be there.
Banff road trip.
We have destroyed most the cuisine in most countries. So
yeah, I was in Iceland this last summer, and they were super excited because they were getting Domino's pizza.
Oh wow!
Talking to my cab driver, I was like, "What's wrong with you, Thor? It's
very good." And yeah, you know, there was KFC, McDonald's, Burger King, just, you know, all sorts of stuff that you know, they shouldn't be eating over there, and we shouldn't be eating over here either. Yeah, we went past one Burger King, like in Gandhi Square in Johannesburg, and they were telling us, oh man, when Burger King opened, oh my God, there were like 4-hour lines to get the food. And I'm like, oh my God, what have we done to your country?
I wouldn't wait 4 minutes. That's crazy. But well, hey, we have to wrap up here pretty soon. But Chris, I know you want to talk a bit about Ron's past history. Did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, if that's okay. I was testing all day today. So I had to look concerned and mentally I could think about your career. And, it struck me how much of your career you were sort of the first guy in on a lot of things happening in comics right now. Like, I remember when you first took over Green Lantern, you immediately had to deal with the embarrassment to every middle-aged comic fan ever, the Hal partisans that were sending you death threats and stuff. And I was just curious, you know, since you were one of the first creators to really have to deal with toxic fan culture, with 20 years of perspective, is the situation gotten any better? Is it gotten any worse? Do we have any cause for hope?
I think it's worse because, you know, there's more access now. If somebody wanted to send me a death threat when, you know, when Emerald Twilight came out 20 years ago, more than 25 years ago now, you know, they actually had to go through the effort of sitting down and writing a letter and putting a stamp on it and sending it into DC's offices. Some of whom put their return address on the envelope. Yeah. Oh, gosh. That's not exaggeration. That's true. So some of those people got a phone call from the, you know, New York City Police Department. So now obviously you're a lot more accessible. Somebody can jump onto Twitter or Facebook and tell you you suck 3 minutes after they read the comic. Doesn't make it any more valid. Doesn't make it any more useful. It's just more immediate. And I think there's less of a filter now because, people that might be pissed off about something, in the time that it takes them to, you know, get out the envelope and the piece of paper and the stamp and actually write the letter, the greater angels of their nature might go, hey, you know what? That's not really a great idea. But now 15 seconds after you have the thought, it's spewed out there on the internet. So, you know, it's part of it, unfortunately. Comics, Star Wars, there are always people who sort of lose sight of the fact that these are made up people that you're getting your, you know, yourself bent out of shape about, and you're abusing real people because of the made up people. It's just something that, you know, as a creator, you have to get used to. And you have to be able to just let it roll off your back. I was initially, I mean, my first job out of college, even while I was in college, was as a newspaper reporter. So I was 19 years old and getting nasty letters from parents whose kids weren't, you know, whose kids' names didn't get mentioned in high school football stories.
Oh, wow.
So very early on, I sort of made my peace with the fact that, you know, you're not going to please everybody. You just do the best job you can and you move on. So by the time I got to comics and people started losing their minds over whatever, you know, I was already, you know, I already had a pretty, pretty thick set of armor and just really approached it as, well, that's fine. You can have an opinion. I don't really care. And I think that's the way you have to look at it. But now obviously things have, you know, really sort of gone over the line of you know, really abusive, insidious behavior, because of the anonymity of it. I mean, this stuff doesn't happen at signings or conventions or anything like that, because the more chance there is of somebody getting punched in the mouth, the less rude people get. You know, that's unfortunately the nature of the internet. Everybody's internet brave until they get face to face, and then suddenly civility seems to take over a bit more. So I have very little patience for it, but that's what they make the mute button and the block button for. You know, those are, as far as I'm concerned, the things that make online interactions tolerable. If you don't like what, you know, if you don't like what somebody says, don't pay attention to them. I said this to a creator the other day. It's like, look, you know, don't talk to these guys. If it's not somebody that you would have a beer with in a bar or a cup of coffee with in a Starbucks, don't even respond. Just ignore them, because most of the abusive stuff comes from people who are just looking for attention. And if you suck the oxygen out of the room and don't give them the attention they want, they go away eventually.
Well, the second thing I wanted to ask you about is very early in your run on Green Lantern, you wound up getting involved in issues of representation and gender roles, and your work sort of inspired the whole women in refrigerators thing. And I thought it was I was in sympathy with what Gail Simone was doing and was trying to do. And I thought you handled yourself with utmost class and understanding on that. But I thought it was a little unfair that your work got singled out. And I felt a bit unfairly. I find it somewhat unfortunate that something you wrote has, you know, sort of carries the name of this trope. But now we're 25 years removed from that. I just thought if you had any reflections given the time that's passed.
You know, my thoughts are much the same as they were then. And Gail and I are friends, and I bear, you know, we're, you know, there's no animosity there, on, you know, either way. I think, you know, her take and her points were totally valid. And to great extent, I think the fact that up until, really maybe even up until 2000, 2005, most comics, certainly most superhero comics, starred male heroes, were directed at a male audience. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm just saying that's the way it was. Mm-hmm. And your heroes were not the ones that ended up getting killed or maimed or having terrible things happen to them. The heroes continued. The supporting cast, which for male heroes was often a girlfriend, a wife, were the ones that suffered, you know, that suffered the slings and arrows. It's the way that some drama could be injected into a series that ultimately has no end. There's no superhero comics are generally middle. There's an origin, and then there's a bunch of middle. There's no end, because they just go on every month. That's their nature. So the, you know, the girlfriend or the female supporting character suffering something terrible because you can't really do that to your you can't really do that with any permanence to your male lead character. Certainly a trope, and it's not a fair trope, but it's one that certainly existed. And still exists. Yes. I think it's certainly better now because we have a lot more female protagonists. I wrote Witchblade for 10 years, a female protagonist, and had a great time doing it. Mm-hmm. I killed off one of her longtime supporting characters, a character that had been around for, 10 years or something like that. Threw him off the top of the Empire State Building. So it was fairly, that was fairly final. Nobody cared. So that's just one of the realities of it too. It was like, a male character, something terrible happens to a male character. You don't, there's not the same reaction. And I'm not saying there should be, it's simply the way it is right now. And mm-hmm. we've got a lot to make up for in terms of the fates that female supporting characters have suffered, and I guess obviously the obvious one that everybody goes to is Gwen Stacy, mm-hmm. Which I can certainly imagine, in the early 70s when that kind of stuff didn't happen in comics at all. I think mm-hmm. probably when it happened, I think there obviously was probably an even greater outcry than when Alex DeWitt suffered her fate in Green Lantern. So, yeah. Look, it's part of my career. It's part of what's going to go on my tombstone. I don't run from it. And I'm glad that it became something that we as an industry and we as creators and readers could talk about.
And thank you for reminding me, Gail Simone is a fabulous person, and I really, really enjoyed the dialogue that you two had. I thought you both acquitted yourselves very, very, very well.
And yeah, well, I don't think we came at it in any way as an antagonistic sort of thing. And, because Gail knows me and she also understands how stories work. Mm-hmm. So there was a dialogue about it rather than, than one side or the other. Tossing slings and arrows. So, I think it's a healthy debate to have, and I think it's healthy for comics as an industry, and even storytelling as an industry.
Yes.
To be aware of it, but also to understand that sometimes really awful things happen to characters you like because that's what the story demands. I think we have to make sure that we as storytellers would, in whatever capacity, mm-hmm. comics, films, novels, don't soft pedal everything either.
Yes.
Romeo and Juliet's a pretty great play, but it doesn't have a happy ending.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. All right. And I also wanted to ask you, we just recently lost the founder of CrossGen Comics. And for those of us who are in the fandom, we've been subjected to 15 years of just incredible stories about what it was like to work at CrossGen. And do you have any perspective on CrossGen you'd like to share with us? Or
some of those stories are true and some of them aren't. Depending on who's telling them and depending on the point of view. It was ultimately a positive experience for me. I learned more about making comics while I was there than I had previously, because we were doing it ourselves. There were no editors and there was nobody other than the creators and the production staff putting those books together. There was a learning curve for management to understand what working with creatives is like. And there was a learning curve for everybody to understand what the market was working like. And I don't look back at it with regret other than I regret the way that it ended. It's unfortunate that it didn't get a chance to grow into something that could have been, I think, pretty vital and pretty permanent in the business. There were, I think, to a certain extent, we were a few years ahead of our time in terms of doing comics that that could be exploited in other media. You know, if you're just getting into comics to sell comics, it's a razor thin margin in terms of the finances of it. Obviously, if your comics are being done both because you love comics and because they might translate into another medium, you know, as the aforementioned Jim Starlin has seen Thanos turn into, you know, the focal point of a multi-billion-dollar film franchise. You know, there's a lot of there's a lot to be said for that sort of transmedia thinking, because that's the world we live in. So, you know, it's unfortunate that the crush end didn't last. There was hubris involved, certainly. There was too much money being spent and not enough money coming in. And the right deals weren't taken advantage of when they were offered. You know, Mark Alessi and I had, you know, had our differences, particularly towards the end. But I think ultimately his heart was in the right place. And he did the best he could with his understanding of how all this worked. And you know, God rest his soul, obviously you don't want anybody to leave this earth that early.
Yes.
Certainly, the way that it ended was really unfortunate, but above and beyond all of it, even the, you know, the people who were left holding the bag financially and all of the unpleasant stuff that went along with the end of CrossGen, Mark Alessi loved comics and he loved comic book characters. And I don't think anybody, even the people that might have disagreed with him most bitterly, would argue that he was, you know, he really loved this, and wanted to make it succeed. The plan just didn't quite work out the way it was supposed to, but for a few years, I think we made some good comics.
Oh yeah. It's neat. I promised myself I would only ask one intensely nerdy question, so I'm going to go ahead and throw that one out here. I was really, really looking forward to the ongoing Kyle Rayner Ion title. And it started at, was announced as an ongoing, and then before it even came out, it got switched over to a 12-issue limited series. What happened with the Ion book?
It got switched over to a 12-issue limited series. You know, the initiative that was put in front of me initially was, hey, we're going to do a regular series. We want you to write it. Okay, great. And then not too long into the process, they said, oh, you know, we're just going to do 12. We're going to, you know, we want to put limits on most of the series that are going to come out at this time. So we did 12. And then we knew that by the time we were getting into the middle point of the series, we knew that we had to put certain things in place at the end of Ion for it to lead into other stories. This is, you know, that's how a shared universe works.
Yes,
you're not completely the captain of your own ship. You sort of have to. You're more like one of the guys pulling on the oars, and you all got to pull in the same direction. an unlimited series would have been great, but that's not how it shook out. And you know, I was happy to go back and play with Kyle again for 12 issues. Had some great artistic collaborators on it as well. It's pretty cool. Anytime you get a chance to work with Greg Ticini and Fernando Passerin, no complaints from me.
One final question. And you created a fabulous character with Kyle. I've just always been a huge, huge fan of your work on that title and that character in particular. It just, Kyle came around. He was a guy who just happened to be in the right alley and got handed the most powerful weapon in the universe. And I was reading that at the same moment that I became a classroom teacher for the first time. And Kyle and I were roughly the same age. And just the idea of this feeling that you've got way more responsibility than you ever asked for, that book really resonated with me. I will always treasure that book. And I thank you for it, sir. I really, really love that book. But you've been in a position now where, you know, Kyle has gone on to other creators and things like that. Have you, what's it like to see something you put so much in your heart and your soul fall into the hands of other talented writers? Have you kept up with Kyle? Have you been a huge fan of anybody else writing Kyle?
Yeah, you know, I stuck my nose in on, you know, sort of a regular basis and just to see what was going on. And I was pretty happy with what Judd Winnick did following me. Mm-hmm. That obviously when it's kind of freshest and you're handing your baby over to somebody else, it's like, you know, particularly after 7 years, it's like watching somebody else raise your kids. So it's a little bit of a curve to get used to, mm-hmm. but you also know that going in. Yes. Even when it's your creation, mm-hmm. when you are working at Marvel or DC, or, you know, any sort of shared universe, you know that ultimately it's not yours. You might have brought it into the world, but ultimately you don't own it. It's not, you don't have final say over it, and you have to make your peace with that ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't, you're just setting yourself up for disappointment. It's a reality of, you know, doing work for hire, is that even if you create something, it's ultimately not yours. And you just hope that it goes into good hands and they do their best by it. And I think generally they have. I think there's been a, as with most characters, for a while the character sort of strays and you know, editorial's not quite sure what they want to do with it. And, mm-hmm. you know, he's had a number of different costumes and became a White Lantern for a while. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's all part of working in that shared universe again. Mm-hmm. It's just once you set it aside and walk away from it, mm-hmm. you have to be accepting of what happens, because otherwise you're just going to mm-hmm. make yourself nuts.
Yes. Well, one of the great con experiences I've ever had, I was talking to Justin Jordan, who wrote the New Guardians, who did most of the Kyle as the White Lantern. And we had a great, great talk about you, about what great fans we both are of your work. And talking about how you inspired both of us. And it was a great conversation. I just kind of wish you could have been there. I think you would probably have enjoyed hearing some of it.
Obviously, you should have recorded it.
I should have. And this is my last thing, and I'll swear I'll shut up. But this is something I wanted to say in a semi-public venue, is I make it a point to come find you at every single Baltimore Comic Con. And because I think you're a very talented person and just a great, great human being. I came to you one year when my best artist friend, who's an even bigger Kyle Rayner than I am, had to miss the show for a surgery. I mentioned that to you. You recorded a video for her and handed me like more signed comics than I could carry. And I think were largely responsible for pulling a dear, dear friend of mine through a very, very, very difficult time in her life. And I can't thank you enough for that. And she's way too shy to really tell you how much it meant to her. But really, I've just enjoyed your work, and you're a great, great person on top of it all. And I had to thank you for that and acknowledge that in public. That means more to us than I can possibly say, as I stagger over my words and prove my own point.
Well, thanks. There's not much I can say except thank you. It's the least we owe each other as decent human beings. You try to do what you can for somebody that needs it. I don't take lightly the fact that I have been able to do this for almost 30 years because people buy what I do. And I don't take the audience lightly, even though I've never been somebody who you know, sits around and goes, man, I wonder what the audience wants so I can provide that to them. Because that's not how this job works. You know, this job works in the way that, you know, you as the creator are responsible to the people that hire you, and you're responsible to yourself for telling the best story that you can tell and that entertains you. I always say that I'm the only audience whose tastes I'm sure of. So I try to tell stories that I would want to read. But beyond that, you know, there's a responsibility to just, you know, to try to do right by people. Because people have done right by me for a long time.
Well, hey, before we wrap up, we're going to put the links in our show notes for the Dreadstar Kickstarter and for Harkins Raiders. I noticed the page says this pre-order is available for first quarter of 2019, but you had mentioned that the artists are in a race to the finish. Do we have an amended release date for that? Maybe summerish or
Q3? Yeah, it'll be summer. By the time everybody finishes up, by the time Daryl finishes up and Sean finishes up, I don't think Jason Masters is going to finish Sean's story. He might not be happy with that. It'll probably take us through the end of the month or so to get everything buttoned up, all the color done, lettering done, and then sent off to press. So we're probably looking at starting to ship out in June and people receiving their stuff late June, early July.
You know, we're a big fan of War Comics. Can we get you back on in June, July to talk about it?
Absolutely. We'll be happy to.
Maybe we can do a good twofer with you and Sean. That could be fun.
Oh, I'll bring the wings.
Long as we talk about chicken wings, I'm sure he's there.
We don't have a trap now.
Do a location podcast. That'll be fun. All right. Ron, big fan of your work. Thank you so much for making time to come on with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Walt, Chris, thanks for your time, and to all our listeners.
You're very welcome. And before we go, Amy Campbell said I would never mention her name on the air. So there you go. My artist friend that he recorded the video for. So that's for her.
Hi, Amy.
Oh, you just made her year.
That drop was somebody hitting the floor.
Indeed.
Nice. All right. Well, hey, we'll catch you all next time on the Banff Podcast.